found to have been falsely accused. That would demonstrate the fairness of the judgments against the others.
We'll have them all before the sun comes up, Your Grace.
Sir Osfrid hesitated.
There's a crowd gathering outside the door of Baelor Sept.
What sort of crowd? Anything unexpected made her wary. She remembered what Lord Waters had said about the riots. I had not considered how the small folk might react to this. Marjorie has been their little pet.
How many? 100 or so. They're shouting for the Aes Septent to release the little queen. We can send them running if you like.
No, let them shout until they're hoarse. It will not sway the sparrow. He only listens to the gods. There was a certain irony in His High Holiness having an angry mob encamped upon his doorstep, since such a mob had raised him to the Crystal Crown, which he promptly sold. The faith has its own knights now. Let them defend the sept. Oh, and close the city gates as well. No one is to enter or leave King's Landing without my leave, until all this is done and settled.
Aren't you come on, Your Grace?
Sir Osfrid bowed and went off to find someone to read the warrants to him. By the time the sun went down that day, all of the accused traitors were in custody. Hamish the Harper had collapsed when they came for him, and Sir Talla the Tall had wounded 3 gold cloaks before the others overwhelmed him. Cersei ordered that the Redwyn twins be given comfortable chambers in a tower. The rest went down to the dungeons.
"Hamish is having difficulty breathing,"
Qyburn informed her when he came to call that night.
"He's calling for a maester.
Tell him he can have one as soon as he confesses," she thought a moment. "He is too old to have been amongst the lovers, but no doubt he was made to play and sing for Marjorie while she was entertaining other men. We will need details.
I shall help him to remember them, Your Grace."
The next day, Lady Merryweather helped Cersei dress for their visit to the little queen. "Nothing too rich or colourful," she said. "Something suitably devout and drab for the High Septon. He's like to make me pray with him." In the end, she chose a soft woolen dress that covered her from throat to ankle, with only a few small vines embroidered on the bodice, and the sleeves in golden thread to soften the severity of its lines. Even better, Brown would help conceal the dirt if she was made to kneel. "And whilst I am comforting my good daughter, you shall speak with the 3 cousins," she told Hyena. "Win Allah if you can, but be careful what you say. The guards may not be the only ones listening." Jamie always said that the hardest part of any battle is just before, waiting for the carnage to begin. When she stepped outside, Cersei saw that the sky was grey and bleak. She could not take the risk of being caught in a downpour, and arriving at Baelor Sept soaked and bedraggled. That meant the litter. For her escort, she took 10 Lannister houseguards and Boris Blunt. "Marjorie's mob may not have the wit to tell one kettle black from another," she told Sir Osmond, "and I cannot have you cutting through the commons. Best we keep you out of sight for a time." As they made their way across King's Landing, Taena had a sudden doubt. "This a trial," she said in a quiet voice. "What if Marjorie demands that her guilt or innocence be determined by wager of battle?" A smile brushed Cersei's lips. "As queen, her honour must be defended by a knight of the king's guard. Why, every child in Westeros knows how Prince Aemon the Dragonite championed his sister, Queen Nereis, against Sir Mogul's accusations. With Sir Loras so gravely wounded, though, I fear Prince Aemon's part must fall to one of his sworn brothers." She shrugged. "Who, though? Sir Aerys and Sir Balon are far away in Dawn. Jaime is off at Riverrun, and Sir Osmond is the brother of the man accusing her, which leaves only, oh dear, Boris Blunt and Meryn Trant." Lady Taena laughed. "Yes, and Sir Meryn has been feeling ill of late. Remind me to tell him that when we return to the castle."
"I shall, my sweet."
Taina took her hand and kissed it. "I pray that I never offend you. You are terrible when aroused."
"Any mother would do the same to protect her children," said Cersei. "When do you mean to bring the boy of yours to court?"
"Russell, was that his name? He could train with Tommen."
"That would thrill the boy, I know, but things are so uncertain just now. I thought it best to wait until the danger passed."
"Soon enough," promised Cersei.
"Send word to Longtable and have Russell pack his best doublet and his wooden sword. A new young friend will be just the thing to help Tommen forget his loss after Margaery's little head has rolled."
They descended from the litter under Blessed Baylor's statue. The queen was pleased to see that the bones and filth had been cleaned away. Sir Osfrid had told it true. The crowd was neither as numerous nor as unruly as the sparrows had been. They stood about in small clumps, gazing sullenly at the doors of the great sept, where a line of Nova Septons had been drawn up with quarterstaffs in their hands.
"No steel," Cersei noted. That was either very wise or very stupid. She was not sure which.
No one made any attempt to hinder her. Small folk and novices alike parted as they passed. Once inside the doors, they were met by three knights in the Hall of Lamps, each clad in the rainbow-striped robes of the warrior's sons.
"I am here to see my good daughter," Cersei told them.
"His High Holiness has been expecting you. I am Sir Theoden the True, formerly Sir Theoden Wells. If your grace will come with me..."
The High Sparrow was on his knees as ever. This time he was praying before their father's altar. Nor did he break off his prayer when the queen approached, but made her wait impatiently until he had finished. Only then did he rise and bow to her.
"Your grace, this is a sad day."
"Oh, very sad. Do we have your leave to speak with Margaery and her cousins?"
She chose a meek and humble manner. With this man, that was like to work the best.
"If that is your wish, come with me afterward, my child. We must pray together, you and I."
The little queen had been confined atop one of the great sept's slender towers. Her cell was 8 feet long and 6 feet wide, with no furnishings but a straw-stuffed pallet and a bench for prayer, a ewer of water, a copy of the seven-pointed star, and a candle to read it by. The only window was hardly wider than an arrow slit. Cersei found Margaery barefoot and shivering, clad in the rough-spun shift of a novice sister. Her locks were all a-tangle, and her feet were filthy.
"They took my clothes from me," the little queen told her, once they were alone. "I wore a gown of ivory lace with freshwater pearls on the bodice, but the scepters laid their hands on me and stripped me to the skin. My cousins, too. Mega sent one scepter crashing into the candles and set her robe afire. I fear for Alla, though. She went as white as milk, too frightened even to cry."
"Poor child." There were no chairs, so Cersei sat beside the little queen on her pallet. "Lady Taina has gone to speak with her, to let her know that she is not forgotten."
"He will not even let me see them," fumed Margaery. "He keeps each of us apart from the others. Until you came, I was allowed no visitors but scepters. One comes every hour to ask if I wish to confess my fornications. They will not even let me sleep. They wake me to demand confessions. Last night I confessed to Scepter Yunella that I wished to scratch her eyes out."
"A shame you did not do it," Cersei thought.
"Blinding some poor old scepter would certainly persuade the High Sparrow of your guilt."
"They are questioning your cousins the same way."
"Damn them, then," said Margaery. "Damn them all to seven hells. Arla is gentle and shy. How can they do this to her? And Mega? She laughs as loud as a duckside whore, I know. But inside, she's still just a little girl. I love them all, and they love me. If this sparrow thinks to make them lie about me..."
"They stand accused as well, I fear, all three."
"My cousins?" Margaery paled. "Arla and Mega are hardly more than children. Your Grace, this is obscene. Will you take us out of here?"
Oh, would that I could! Her voice was full of sorrow. His High Holiness has his new knights guarding you. To free you, I would need to send the gold cloaks and profane this holy place with killing.
Cersei took Margaery's hand in hers.
I have not been idle, though. I have gathered up all those that Sir Osney named as your lovers. They will tell his High Holiness of your innocence, I am certain, and swear to it at your trial.
Trial?
There was real fear in the girl's voice now. Must there be a trial?
How else will you prove your innocence?
Cersei gave Margaery's hand a reassuring squeeze.
It is your right to decide the manner of the trial, to be sure. You are the queen. The knights of the king's guard are sworn to defend you.
Margaery understood at once.
A trial by battle. Loras is hurt, though. Elsewise he...
He has six brothers.
Margaery stared at her, then pulled her hand away.
Is that a jape? Boris is a craven.
Meryn is old and slow, your brother is maimed, the other two are off in Dawn, and Osmond is a bloody kettle-black. Loras has two brothers, not six. If there's to be a trial by battle, I want Garlon as my champion.
Sir Garlon is not a member of the King's Guard, the Queen said. When the Queen's honour is at issue, law and custom require that her champion be one of the King's sworn seven. The High Septon will insist, I fear.
I will make certain of it.
Margaery did not answer at once, but her brown eyes narrowed in suspicion.
Blunt or Trant, she said at last. It would have to be one of them. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Osney Kettleblack would cut either one to pieces.
Oh, seven hells.
Cersei donned a look of hurt.
You wrong me, daughter. All I want is your son. All for yourself. He will never have a wife that you don't hate.
And I am not your daughter, thank the gods. Leave me. You are being foolish. I am only here to help you.
To help me to my grave.
I ask for you to leave. Will you make me call my jailers and have you dragged away, you vile, scheming, evil bitch?
Cersei gathered up her skirts and dignity.
This must be very frightening for you. I shall forgive those words. Here, as at court, one never knew who might be listening. I would be afraid as well in your place. Grand Maester Pycelle has admitted providing you with moon tea and your blue bard. If I were you, my lady, I would pray to the crone for wisdom, and to the mother for her mercy. I fear you may soon be in dire need of both.
Four shriveled scepters escorted the queen down the tower steps. Each of the crones seemed more feeble than the last. When they reached the ground, they continued down, into the heart of Visenya's hill. The steps ended well below the earth, where a line of flickering torches lit a long hallway. She found the High Septon waiting for her in a small seven-sided audience chamber. The room was sparse and plain, with bare stone walls, a rough-hewn table, three chairs, and a prayer bench. The faces of the seven had been carved into the walls. Cersei thought the carvings crude and ugly, but there was a certain power to them, especially about the eyes. Orbs of onyx, malachite and yellow moonstone that somehow made their faces come alive.
"You spoke with a queen,"
the High Septon said.
She resisted the urge to say, "I am the queen."
"I did. All men sin, even kings and queens. I have sinned myself and been forgiven. Without confession, though, there can be no forgiveness. The queen will not confess."
"Perhaps she is innocent."
"Oh, she is not. Holy scepters have examined her and testified that her maidenhead is broken. She has drunk a moon tea to murder the fruit of her fornications in her womb. An anointed knight has sworn upon his sword to having carnal knowledge of her and two of her three cousins. Others have lain with her as well, he says, and names, many names, of men both great and humble.
My girl cloaks have taken all of them to the dungeons," Cersei assured him. "Only one has yet been questioned, a singer called the Blue Bard.
What he had to say was disturbing. Even so, I pray that when my good daughter is brought to trial, her innocence may yet be proved.
She hesitated.
Tommen loves his little queen so much, Your Holiness, I fear it might be hard for him or his lords to judge her justly. Perhaps the Faith should conduct the trial.
The High Sparrow steepled his thin hands.
I have had the self-same thought, Your Grace, just as Magor the Cruel once took the swords from the Faith. So, Jaehaerys the Conciliator deprived us of the scales of judgment. Yet who is truly fit to judge a queen, save the seven above, and the gods sworn below? A sacred court of seven judges shall sit upon this case. Three shall be of your female sex, a maiden, a mother, and a crone. Who could be more suited to judge the wickedness of women?
That would be for the best. To be sure, Margaery does have the right to demand that her guilt or innocence be proven by wager of battle. If so, her champion must be one of Tommen's seven.
The knights of the King's Guard have served as rightful champions of king and queen since the days of Aegon the Conqueror. Crown and Faith speak as one on this.
Cersei covered her face with her hands, as if in grief. When she raised her head again, a tear glistened in one eye.
"These are sad days indeed," she said. "But I am pleased to find us so much in agreement. If Tommen were here, I know he would thank you. Together you and I must find the truth."
"We shall."
"I must return to the castle. With your leave, I will take Sir Osney Kettleblack back with me. The small council want to question him and hear his accusations for themselves."
"No,"
said the High Septon. It was only a word, one little word, but to Cersei it felt like a splash of icy water in her face. She blinked, and her certainty flickered just a little.
"Sir Osney will be held securely, I promise you."
"He is held securely here. Come, I will show you."
Cersei could feel the eyes of the seven staring at her, eyes of jade and malachite and onyx, and a sudden shiver of fear went through her, cold as ice. "I am the queen," she told herself, "Lord Tywin's daughter." Reluctantly, she followed. Sir Osney was not far. The chamber was dark and closed by a heavy iron door. The High Septon produced the key to open it, and took a torch down from the wall to light the room within.
"After you, Your Grace."
Within, Osney Kettleblack hung naked from the ceiling, swinging from a pair of heavy iron chains. He had been whipped, his back and shoulders been laid almost bare, and cuts and welts crisscrossed, his legs and arse as well. The queen could hardly stand to look at him. She turned back to the High Septon.
"What have you done?"
"We have sought after the truth most earnestly."
"He told you the truth. He came to you of his own free will and confessed his sins."
"Aye, he did that. I've heard many men confess, Your Grace, but seldom have I heard a man so pleased to be so guilty."
"You whipped him?"
"There can be no penance without pain. No man should spare himself the scourge, as I told Sir Osney. I seldom feel so close to God as when I'm being whipped for mine own wickedness, though my darkest sins are no wise near as black as his."
But, she sputtered, "you preach the mother's mercy."
"Sir Osney shall taste of that sweet milk in the afterlife. In the seven-pointed star it is written that all sins may be forgiven, but crimes must still be punished. Osney Kettleblack is guilty of treason and murder, and the wages of treason are death."
"He's just a priest. He cannot do this."
"It is not for the Faith to condemn a man to death, whatever his offence." "Whatever his offence."
The High Septon repeated the words slowly, weighing them.
Strange to say, Your Grace, the more diligently we applied the scourge, the more Sir Osney's offences seemed to change. He would now have us believe that he never touched Marjorie Tyrrell. Is that not so, Sir Osney?
Osney Kettleblack opened his eyes. When he saw the Queen standing there before him, he ran his tongue across his swollen lips and said,
"The wall! You promised me the wall!"
"He is mad," said Cersei. "You have driven him mad."
"Sir Osney," said the High Septon, in a firm, clear voice, "did you have carnal knowledge of the Queen?"
"Aye."
The chains rattled softly as Osney twisted in his shackles.
"That one there, she's a queen I fucked. The one sent me to kill the old High Septon. He never had no guards. I just come in when he was sleeping and pushed a pillow down across his face."
Cersei whirled and ran. The High Septon tried to seize her, but he was some old sparrow and she was a lioness of the rock. She pushed him aside and burst through the door, slamming it behind her with a clang.
"The Kettleblacks. I need the Kettleblacks. I will send in Usfrid with the gold cloaks and Usman with the King's Guard. Usney will deny it all. Once they cut him free, and I'll rid myself of this High Septon just as I did the other."
The four old scepters blocked her way and clutched at her with wrinkled hands. She knocked one to the floor and clawed another across the face and gained the steps. Halfway up she remembered Tyena Merryweather. It made her stumble, panting.
"Seven, save me," she prayed. "Tyena knows it all. If they take her too and whip her—"
She ran as far as the sept, but no further. There were women waiting for her there, more scepters and silent sisters too, younger than the four old crones below.
"I am the queen," she shouted, backing away from them. "I will have your heads for this. I will have all your heads. Let me pass."
Instead, they laid hands upon her. Cersei ran to the altar of the mother, but they caught her there, a score of them, and dragged her, kicking up the tower steps. Inside the cell, three silent sisters held her down as a scepter named Scalera stripped her bare. She even took her small clothes. Another scepter tossed a rough-spun shift at her.
"You cannot do this!" the queen kept screaming at them. "I am a Lannister! Unhand me! My brother will kill you! Jaime will slice you open from throat to cunt! Unhand me! I am the queen!"
"The queen should pray,"
said Scepter Scalera, before they left her naked in the cold, bleak cell. She was not meek Marjorie Tyrrell to don her little shift and submit to such captivity.
"I will teach them what it means to put a lion in a cage," Cersei thought.
She tore the shift into 100 pieces, found a ewer of water, and smashed it against the wall, then did the same with the chamber pot. When no one came, she began to pound on the door with her fists. Her escort was below, on the plaza. 10 Lannister guardsmen and Sir Boris Blunt.
"Once they hear, they'll come free me, and we'll drag the bloody High Sparrow back to the Red Keep in chains."
She screamed and kicked and howled until her throat was raw, at the door and at the window. No one shouted back, nor came to rescue her. The cell began to darken. It was growing cold as well. Cersei began to shiver.
"How can they leave me like this, without so much as a fire? I am their queen."
She began to regret tearing apart the shift they'd given her. There was a blanket on the pallet in the corner, a threadbare thing of thin brown wool. It was rough and scratchy, but it was all she had. Cersei huddled underneath to keep from shivering, and before long she had fallen into an exhausted sleep. The next she knew, a heavy hand was shaking her awake. It was black as pitch inside the cell, and a huge, ugly woman was kneeling over her, a candle in her hand.
"Who are you?" the queen demanded. "Are you come to set me free?"
"I am Scepter Yunella. I've come to hear you tell of all your murders and fornications."
Cersei knocked her hand aside.
"I will have your head. Do not presume to touch me. Get away."
The woman rose.
Your Grace, I will be back in an hour. Mayhaps by then you'll be ready to confess.
An hour, and an hour, and an hour. So passed the longest night that Cersei Lannister had ever known, save for the night of Joffrey's wedding. Her throat was so raw from shouting that she could hardly swallow. The cell turned freezing cold. She had smashed the chamber pot, so she had to squat in a corner to make her water and watch it trickle across the floor. Every time she closed her eyes, Yunella was looming over her again, shaking her and asking her if she wanted to confess her sins. Day brought no relief. Septa Moel brought her a bowl of some watery grey gruel as the sun was coming up. Cersei flung it at her head. When they brought a fresh ewer of water, though, she was so thirsty she had no choice but to drink. When they brought another shift, grey and thin and smelling of mildew, she put it on over her nakedness. And that evening, when Moel appeared again, she ate the bread and fish and demanded wine to wash it down. No wine appeared, only Septa Yunella making her hourly visit to ask if the queen was ready to confess.
"What can be happening?" Cersei wondered, as the thin slice of sky outside her window began to darken once again. "Why has no one come to pry me out of here? She could not believe that the Kettle Blacks would abandon their brother. What was her council doing? Cravens and traitors, when I get out of here I will have the lot of them beheaded, and find better men to take their place."
Thrice that day she heard the sound of distant shouting, drifting up from the plaza. But it was Margaery's name that the mob was calling, not hers. It was near dawn on the second day, and Cersei was licking the last of the porridge from the bottom of the bowl, when her cell door swung open unexpectedly to admit Lord Qyburn. It was all she could do not to throw herself at him.
"Qyburn!" she whispered. "Oh, gods, I'm so glad to see your face. Take me home."
"That will not be allowed. You are to be tried before a holy court of seven for murder, treason, and fornication." Cersei was so exhausted that the words seemed nonsensical to her at first.
"Tommen, tell me of my son. Is he still king?"
"He is, Your Grace. He is safe and well, secure within the walls of Maegor's Holdfast, protected by the king's guard. He is lonely, though, fretful. He asks for you, and for his little queen. As yet, no one has told him of your difficulties,
she suggested. "What of Margaery?"
"She is to be tried as well, by the same court that conducts your trial. I had the blue bard delivered to the High Septon, as Your Grace commanded. He is here now, somewhere down below us. My whisperers tell me that they are whipping him, but so far he is still singing the same sweet song we taught him."
The same sweet song. Her wits were dull for want of sleep. What his real name is what? If the gods were good, what might die beneath the lash, leaving Margaery with no way to disprove his testimony?
"Where are my knights? Sir Osfrid, the High Septon means to kill his brother, Osney. His gold cloaks must—"
"Osfrid Kettleblack no longer commands a city watch. The king has removed him from office, and raised the captain of the Dragon Gate in his place. A certain Humphrey Waters."
Cersei was so tired, none of this made any sense.
Why would Tommen do that?
"The boy is not to blame. When his council puts a decree in front of him, he signs his name and stamps it with his seal."
"My council? Who? Who would do that?
Not you." "Alas, I have been dismissed from the council, although for the nonce they allow me to continue my work with the eunuchs, Whisperers. The realm is being ruled by Sir Harry Swift and Grand Maester Pycelle. They have dispatched a raven to Castle Rock, inviting your uncle to return to court and assume the regency. If he means to accept, he had better make haste. Maesterel has abandoned his siege of Storm's End and is marching back to the city with his army, and Randall Tarly is reported on his way down from Maidenpool as well."
Has Lord Merryweather agreed to this?
Merryweather has resigned his seat on the council and fled back to Longtable with his wife, who was the first to bring us news of the accusations against your Grace.
They let Tyena go?
That was the best thing she had heard since the High Sparrow had said no. Tyena could have doomed her.
What of Lord Waters, his ships? If he brings his crews ashore, he should have enough men to—
As soon as word of your Grace's present troubles reached the river, Lord Waters raised sail, unshipped his oars, and took his fleet to sea. Sir Harris fears he means to join Lord Stannis. Pycelle believes that he is sailing to the Stepstones to set himself up as a pirate.
"Oh, my lovely Drummonds," Cersei almost laughed. "My lord father used to say that bastards are treacherous by nature. Would that I had listened." She shivered. "I am lost, Qyburn."
"No," he took her hand. "Hope remains. Your Grace has the right to prove your innocence by battle. My queen, your champion, stands ready. There is no man in all the Seven Kingdoms who can hope to stand against him. If you will only give the command."
This time she did laugh. It was funny, terribly funny, hideously funny. "The guards make japes of all our hopes and plans. I have a champion no man can defeat, but I am forbidden to make use of him. I am the queen, Qyburn. My honour can only be defended by a sworn brother of the king's guard."
"I see."
The smile died on Qyburn's face.
"Your Grace, I am at a loss. I do not know how to counsel you."
Even in her exhausted, frightened state, the queen knew she dare not trust her fate to a court of sparrows. Nor could she count on Sir Kevin to intervene, after the words that had passed between them at their last meeting. It will have to be a trial by battle. There's no other way. "Qyburn, for the love you bear me, I beg you, send a message for me. A raven, if you can, a rider, if not. You must send to Riveron to my brother. Tell him what has happened, and write... Yes, your Grace?" She licked her lips, shivering.
"Come at once. Help me. Save me. I need you now as I have never needed you before. I love you. I love you. I love you. Come at once."
"As you command. I love you thrice."
Thrice. She had to reach him.
"He will come. I know he will. He must. Jamie is my only hope."
"My queen," said Qyburn, "have you forgotten? Sir Jamie has no sword hand. If he should champion you and lose,
we will leave this world together, as we once came into it."
"He will not lose. Not Jamie. Not with my life at stake."
Jamie. The new lord of Riveron was so angry that he was shaking.
"We have been deceived," he said. "This man had played us false."
Pink spittle flew from his lips as he jabbed a finger at Edmure Tully.
"I will have his head off. I rule in Riveron by the king's own decree."
"Emon," said his wife,
"the Lord Commander knows about the king's decree. Sir Edmure knows about the king's decree. The stable boys know about the king's decree.
I am the Lord, and I will have his head."
"For what crime?"
Thin as he was, Edmure still looked more lordly than Emon Frey. He wore a quilted doublet of red wool with a leaping trout embroidered on its chest. His boots were black, his breeches blue. His auburn hair had been washed and barbered, his red beard neatly trimmed.
"I did all that was asked of me."
"Oh?" Jamie Lannister had not slept since Riveron had opened its gates, and his head was pounding. "I do not recall asking you to let Sir Brynden escape."
"You required me to surrender my castle, not my uncle. Am I to blame if your men let him slip through their siege lines?"
Jamie was not amused.
"Where is he?"
he said, letting his irritation show. His men had searched River Run thrice over, and Brynden Tully was nowhere to be found.
He never told me where he meant to go.
And you never asked? How did he get out?
Fish swim. Even black ones.
Edmure smiled. Jamie was sorely tempted to crack him across the mouth with his golden hand. A few missing teeth would put an end to his smiles. For a man who was going to spend the rest of his life a prisoner, Edmure was entirely too pleased with himself.
"We have oubliettes beneath the castle rock that fit a man as tight as a suit of armour. You can't turn in them, or sit, or reach down to your feet when the rats start gnawing at your toes. Would you care to reconsider that answer?"
Lord Edmure's smile went away.
"You gave me your word that I would be treated honourably, as befits my rank."
"So you shall," said Jamie. "Nobler knights than you have died whimpering in those oubliettes. And many a high lord, too, even a king or two, if I recall my history. Your wife can have the one beside you, if you like. I would not want to part you."
"He did swim," said Edmure sullenly. He had the same blue eyes as his sister, Caitlin, and Jamie saw the same loathing there that he'd once seen in hers. "We raised the portcullis on the water gate, not all the way, just 3 feet or so, enough to leave a gap under the water, though the gate still appeared to be closed. My uncle is a strong swimmer. After dark he pulled himself beneath the spikes, and he slipped under our boom the same way, no doubt. A moonless night, bored guards, a black fish in a black river, floating quietly downstream. If Rutiger or you or any of their men heard a splash, they would put it down to a turtle or a trout. Edmure had waited most of the day before hauling down the dire wolf of Stark in token of surrender. In the confusion of the castle changing hands, it had been the next morning before Jamie had been informed that the blackfish was not among the prisoners. He went to the window and gazed out over the river. It was a bright autumn day, and the sun was shining on the waters. By now, the blackfish could be 10 leagues downstream. "You have to find him," insisted Emonfrey. "He'll be found." Jamie spoke with a certainty he did not feel. "I have hounds and hunters sniffing after him even now."
Sir Adam Marbrant was leading the search on the south side of the river, Sir Dermot of the Rainwood on the north. He had considered enlisting the river lords as well, but Vance and Piper and their ilk were more like to help the blackfish escape than clap him into fetters. All in all, he was not hopeful. "He may elude us for a time," he said, "but eventually he must surface."
"What if he should try and take my castle back?"
"You have a garrison of 200.
Too large a garrison, in truth, but Lord Emmon had an anxious disposition. At least he would have no trouble feeding them. The blackfish had left River Run amply provisioned, just as he had claimed. After the trouble, Sir Brynden took to leave us. I doubt that he'll come skulking back, unless it is at the head of a band of outlaws. He did not doubt that the blackfish meant to continue the fight.
"This is your seat," Lady Jenner told her husband. "It is for you to hold it. If you cannot do that, put it to the torch and run back to the rock."
Lord Emmon rubbed his mouth. His hand came away red and slimy from the sour leaf.
"And to be sure, River Run is mine, and no man shall ever take it from me."
He gave Edmure Tully one last suspicious look as Lady Jenner drew him from the solar. "Is there any more that you would care to tell me?" Jamie asked Edmure, when the two of them were alone.
"This was my father's solar," said Tully. "He ruled the riverlands from here, wisely and well. He liked to sit beside that window. The light was good there, and whenever he looked up from his work, he could see the river. When his eyes were tired, he would have Cat read to him. Littlefinger and I built a castle out of wooden blocks once, there beside the door. You will never know how sick it makes me to see you in this room, Kingslayer."
You will never know how much I despise you. He was wrong about that. I have been despised by better men than you, Edmure. Jamie called for a guard. Take his lordship back to his tower, and see that he's fed. The Lord of River Run went silently. On the morrow he would start west. Sir Fawley Prester would command his escort, 100 men, including 20 knights. Best double that. Lord Berwick may try to free Edmure before they reach the Golden Tooth. Jamie did not want to have to capture Tolly for a third time. He returned to Huster Tolly's chair, pulled over the map of the Trident, and flattened it beneath his golden hand. Where would I go if I were the Blackfish?
Lord Commander!
A guardsman stood in the open door.
Lady Westling and her daughter are without, as you commanded.
Jamie shoved the map aside. Show them in. At least the girl did not vanish, too. Jane Westling had been Robb Stark's queen, the girl who cost him everything. With a wolf in her belly, she could have proved more dangerous than the Blackfish. She did not look dangerous. Jane was a willowy girl, no more than 15 or 16, more awkward than graceful. She had narrow hips, breasts the size of apples, a mop of chestnut curls, and the soft brown eyes of a doe. Pretty enough for a child, Jamie decided, but not a girl to lose a kingdom for. Her face was puffy, and there was a scab on her forehead, half hidden by a lock of brown hair. "What happened there?" he asked her. The girl turned her head away. "Oh, it is nothing," insisted her mother, a stern-faced woman in a gown of green velvet. A necklace of gold seashells looped about her long, thin neck. "She would not give up the little crown the rebel gave her, and when I tried to take it from her head, the willful child fought me.
It was mine," James sobbed. "You had no right. Robb had it made for me. I loved him."
Her mother made to slap her, but Jamie stepped between them. "None of that," he warned Lady Sybil. "Sit down, both of you." The girl curled up in her chair like a frightened animal, but her mother sat stiffly, her head high. "Will you have wine?" he asked them. The girl did not answer.
"No, thank you," said her mother.
"As you will." Jamie turned to the daughter. "I'm sorry for your loss. The boy had courage, I'll give him that. There is a question I must ask you. Are you carrying his child, my lady?" Jane burst from her chair and would have fled the room if the guard at the door had not seized her by the arm.
"She is not," said Lady Sybil,
as her daughter struggled to escape. "I made certain of that, as your lord father bid me." Jamie nodded. Tywin Lannister was not a man to overlook such details. "Unhand the girl," he said. "I'm done with her for now." As Jane fled sobbing down the stairs, he considered her mother. "House Westerling has its pardon, and your brother Rolf has been made Lord of Castamere. What else would you have of us?
Your lord father promised me worthy marriages for Jane and her younger sister. Lords or heirs, he swore to me, not younger sons nor household knights."
Lords or heirs, to be sure. The Westlings were an old house and proud, but Lady Sybil herself had been born a Spicer from a line of upjumped merchants. Her grandmother had been some sort of half-mad witch-woman from the East, he seemed to recall, and the Westlings were impoverished. Younger sons would have been the best that Sybil Spicer's daughters could have hoped for in the ordinary course of events, but a nice fat pot of Lannister gold would make even a dead rebel's widow look attractive to some lord. "You'll have your marriages," said Jamie, "but Jane must wait 2 full years before she weds again. If the girl took another husband too soon and had a child by him, inevitably there would come whispers that the young wolf was the father."
"I have 2 sons as well," Lady Westling reminded him. "Rollam is with me, but Reynald was a knight and went with the rebels to the Twins. If I'd known what was to happen there, I would never have allowed that.
There was a hint of reproach in her voice. "Reynard knew naught of any of the understanding with your lord father. He may be a captive at the Twins." "Or he may be dead. Walter Frey would not have known of the understanding either. I will make inquiries. If Sir Reynald is still a captive, we'll pay his ransom for you. Mention was made of a match for him as well, a bride from Castle Rock. Your lord father said that Reynald should have the joy of him, if all went as we hoped."
"Even from the grave, Lord Tywin's dead hand moves us all. Joy is my late Uncle Geryon's natural daughter. A betrothal can be arranged, if that is your wish, but any marriage will need to wait. Joy was 9 or 10 when I last saw her."
"His natural daughter?" Lady Sybil looked as if she had swallowed a lemon. "You want a Westerling to wed a bastard?"
"No more than I want Joy to marry the son of some scheming turncloak bitch. She deserves better. Jamie would happily have strangled the woman with her seashell necklace. Joy was a sweet child, albeit a lonely one. Her father had been Jamie's favourite uncle. Your daughter is worth 10 of you, my lady. You'll leave with Edmure and Sir Fawley on the morrow. Until then, you would do well to stay out of my sight." He shouted for a guardsman, and Lady Sybil went off with her lips pressed primly together. Jamie had to wonder how much Lord Gawain knew about his wife's scheming.
How much do we men ever know?
When Edmure and the Westlings departed, 400 men rode with them. Jamie had doubled the escort again at the last moment. He rode with them a few miles to talk with Sir Fawley Prester, though he bore a bull's head upon his surcoat and horns upon his helm. Sir Fawley could not have been less bovine. He was a short, spare, hard-bitten man. With his pinched nose, bald pate, and grizzled brown beard, he looked more like an innkeep than a knight. "We don't know where the Blackfish is," Jamie reminded him, "but if he can cut Edmure free, he will."
"That will not happen, my lord."
Like most innkeeps, Sir Fawley was no man's fool.
"Scouts and outriders will screen our march, and will fortify our camps by night. I have picked 10 men to stay with Tully day and night, my best longbowman. If he should ride so much as a foot off the road, they will loose so many shafts at him that his own mother would take him for a goose."
"Good. Jamie would as lief have Tully reach Castle Rock safely, but better dead than fled. Best keep some archers near Lord Westerling's daughter as well." Sir Fawley seemed taken back.
"Gowan's girl? She's—"
"The young wolf's widow," Jamie finished, "and twice as dangerous as Edmure if she were ever to escape us."
"As you say, my lord, she will be watched."
Jamie had to canter past the Westerlings as he rode down the column on his way back to Riveron. Lord Gawain nodded gravely as he passed, but Lady Sybil looked through him with eyes like chips of ice. Jane never saw him at all. The widow rode with downcast eyes, huddled beneath a hooded cloak. Underneath its heavy folds, her clothes were finely made, but torn. She ripped them herself. As a mark of mourning, Jamie realized. That could not have pleased her mother. He found himself wondering if Cersei would tear her gown, if she should ever hear that he was dead. He did not go straight back to the castle, but crossed the Tumblestone once more to call on Edwin Frey and discuss the transfer of his great-grandfather's prisoners. The Frey host had begun to break up within hours of River Run's surrender. As Lord Warder's bannermen and free riders pulled up stakes to make for home, the Freys who still remained were striking camp, but he found Edwin with his bastard uncle in the latter's pavilion. The two of them were huddled over a map, arguing heatedly, but they broke off when Jamie entered.
"Lord Commander,"
River said with cold courtesy,
but Edwin blurted out, "My father's blood is in your hands, sir."
That took Jamie a bit aback.
"How so?" "You were the one
who sent him home, were you not?
Someone had to. Has some ill befallen Sir Ryman?
Hanged, with all his party, said Walder Rivers. The outlaws caught them 2 leagues south of Fairmarket.
Dondarrion?
Him, Ortharus, or this woman, Stoneheart?
Jamie frowned. Ryman Frey had been a fool, a craven, and a sot, and no one was like to miss him much, least of all his fellow Freys. If Edwin's dry eyes were any clue, even his own sons would not mourn him long. Still, these outlaws are growing bold. If they dare hang Lord Walder's heir, not a day's ride from the twins. How many men did Sir Ryman have with him? He asked.
3 knights and 12 men-at-arms, said Rivers. It's almost as if they knew that he would be returning to the twins, and with a small escort.
Edwin's mouth twisted.
My brother had a hand in this, I'll wager. He allowed the outlaws to escape after they murdered Merritt and Peter.
And this is why. With our father dead, there's only me left between Black Walder and the twins.
You have no proof of this, said Walder Rivers.
I do not need proof. I know my brother.
Your brother is at Seaguard, Rivers insisted. How could he have known that Sir Ryman was returning to the twins?
Someone told him, said Edwin, in a bitter tone. He has his spies in our camp, you can be sure.
And you have yours at Seaguard. Jamie knew that the enmity between Edwin and Black Walder ran deep, but cared not a fig which of them succeeded their great-grandfather as Lord of the Crossing. If you will pardon me for intruding on your grief, he said in a dry tone, we have other matters to consider. When you return to the twins, please inform Lord Walder that King Tommen requires all the captives you took at the Red Wedding.
Sir Walder frowned. These prisoners are valuable, sir.
His Grace would not ask them if they were worthless. Frey and Rivers exchanged a look.
Edwin said, My Lord Grandfather will expect a recompense for these prisoners.
And he'll have it, as soon as I grow a new hand, thought Jamie. We all have expectations, he said mildly. Tell me, is a Sir Reynold Westling amongst these captives?
The Knight of Seashells, Edwin sneered. You'll find that one feeding the fish at the bottom of the Green Fork.
He was in the yard when our men came to put the direwolf down, said Walder Rivers.
Wallen demanded his sword, and he gave it over meekly enough. But when the cross bowman began feathering the wolf, he seized Wallen's axe and cut the monster loose of the net they'd thrown over him. Wallen says he took a quarrel in his shoulder and another in the gut, but still managed to reach the wall walk and throw himself into the river.
He left a trail of blood on the steps, said Edwin.
Did you find his corpse afterward? Asked Jamie.
We found 1,000 corpses afterward. Once they've spent a few days in the river, they all look much the same.
I've heard the same is true of hanged men, said Jamie before he took his leave. By the next morning, little remained of the Frey encampment but flies, horse dung, and Sir Ryman's gallows, standing forlorn beside the tumblestone. His cars wanted to know what should be done with it, and with the siege equipment he had built, his rams and sows and towers and trebuchets. Davin proposed that they drag it all to Raventree and use it there. Jamie told him to put everything to the torch, starting with the gallows. I mean to deal with Lord Titus myself. It won't require a siege tower.
Davin grinned through his bushy beard. Single combat, cos? Scarce seems fair. Titus is an old grey man.
An old grey man with 2 hands. That night he and Sir Ilion fought for 3 hours. It was one of his better nights. If they had been in earnest, pain only would have killed him twice. 6 deaths were more the rule, and some nights were worse than that. If I keep at this for another year, I may be as good as Peck, Jamie declared, and Sir Ilion made that clacking sound that meant he was amused.
Come, let's drink some more of Hoster Tolle's good red wine. Wine had become a part of their nightly ritual. Sir Ian made the perfect drinking companion. He never interrupted, never disagreed, never complained, or asked for favours, or told long, pointless stories. All he did was drink and listen. I should have the tongues removed from all my friends, said Jamie, as he filled their cups. And from my kin as well. Ah, a silent Cersei would be sweet. Though I'd miss her tongue when we kissed. He drank. The wine was a deep red, sweet and heavy. It warmed him going down. I can't remember the first time we kissed. It was innocent at first. Until it wasn't. He finished the wine and set his cup aside. Tyrion once told me that most whores will not kiss you. They fuck you blind, he said, but you'll never feel their lips on yours. Do you think my sister kisses Kettleback? Sir Ilion did not answer. I don't think it would be proper for me to slay mine own sworn brother. What I need to do is geld him and send him to the wall. That's what they did with Lucamore the Lusty. Sir Osmond may not take kindly to the gelding, to be sure. And there are his brothers to consider. Brothers can be dangerous. After Aegon the Unworthy put Sir Terence Toyne to death for sleeping with his mistress, Toyne's brothers did their best to kill him. Their best was not quite good enough, thanks to the Dragon Knight, but it was not for want of trying. It's written down in the White Book, all of it, save what to do with Cersei. Sir Ilion drew a finger across his throat. No, said Jamie. Tommen has lost a brother, and the man he thought of is his father. If I were to kill his mother, he would hate me for it, and that sweet little wife of his would find a way to turn that hatred to the benefit of Highgarden. Sir Ilion smiled, in a way Jamie did not like. An ugly smile, an ugly soul. You talk too much, he told the man. The next day, Sir Dermot of the Rainwood returned to the castle, empty-handed. When asked what he had found, he answered, "Wolves! Hundreds of the bloody beggars!" He'd lost 2 centuries to them. The wolves had come out of the dark to savage them. Armed men, in mail and boiled leather, and yet the beasts had no fear of them. Before he died, Jake said the pack was led by a she-wolf of monstrous size. A dire-wolf! To hear him tell it. The wolves got in amongst our horse lines, too. The bloody bastards killed my favourite bay. A ring of fires around your camp might keep them off, said Jamie, though he wondered. Could Sir Dermot's direwolf be the same beast that had mauled Joffrey near the crossroads? Wolves or no, Sir Dermot took fresh horses and more men and went out again the next morning to resume the search for Brynden Tully. That same afternoon the lords of the Trident came to Jamie, asking his leave to return to their own lands. He granted it. Lord Piper also wanted to know about his son Mark. All the captives will be ransomed, Jamie promised. As the river lords took their leave, Lord Carl Vance lingered to say,
Lord Jamie, you must go to Raventree. So long as it is Jonas at his gates, Titus will never yield. And I know he will bend his knee for you.
Jamie thanked him for his counsel. Strongbore was the next to depart. He wanted to return to Derry as he'd promised and fight the outlaws.
We rode across half the bloody realm. And for what? So you can make Edmure Tully piss his britches? There's no song in that. I need a fight. I want the hound, Jamie. Him or the Marcher Lord?
The hound's head is yours, if you can take it, Jamie said. But Beric Dondarrion is to be captured alive, so he can be brought back to King's Landing. 1,000 people need to see him die, or else he won't stay dead. Strongbore grumbled at that, but finally agreed. The next day he departed with his squire and men-at-arms, plus beardless John Betley, who had decided that hunting outlaws was preferable to returning to his famously homely wife. Supposedly she had the beard that Betley lacked.
Jaime still had the garrison to deal with. To a man they swore they knew nothing of Sir Brynden's plans or where he might have gone.
"They are lying,"
Emmon Frey insisted. But Jaime thought not. "If you share your plans with no one, no one can betray you," he pointed out. Lady Jenner suggested